Hi, everybody. We heard shouts in the audience during the wonderful Smithsonian Countdown Leaders about Matt. So Matt Soar's here to tell you about this world premiere, let's call it, that we're about to watch. So please welcome Matt Soar from Concordia U.
Thank you very much, Dan. Leaders are ontologically peculiar objects, I'm finding. Maybe you were there already. They're meant to be read, but then they're meant to be viewed, but then they're not meant to be seen at all. And I'm 7 years into the project called Lost Leaders, lostleaders.ca, and of course now I see them everywhere, and I dream about them. I was watching SpongeBob this morning with my cornflakes, and there was some leader. They're everywhere. On the website, I have now found leaders. I'm sure a lot of you already knew this in a lot of experimental works historically. They appear in pop culture, in movies and documentaries as narrative and editing devices. They use gratuitously in really, really bad 1980s music videos. And there are many industry examples, interpretations, and variants. On the website, you can find an amazing society, a variant produced by NASA. There's another one that we think is from Xerox, and thank you to George Willimon for that. And of course, we saw this amazing amazing Smithsonian leader. I want that one too. It's like it started to turn into collecting butterflies. It's a little bit strange. I'm particularly enamored of the Academy leader right now. And if anybody has any tips on how to find out more about art departments at studios and labs around 1930, that would be great. Finding an excuse to participate in Orphans is always a challenge for me. How do I wedge those leaders in there? And I definitely wanted to insinuate myself into this one. I've been to two already and I've had a great time. I also know and understand that if you're organizing an event, there's a certain kind of leap of faith. There's a risk that you're taking with presenters. I'm not even sure if Dan has actually seen the film we're about to show. So bless him for that. You haven't? Okay. You might want to leave now. It's a bit of a mess. My love for Dan goes like this. I decided, how am I going to insinuate myself into Orphans in New York in 2018? I emailed him informally and said, look, before I put in a formal proposal, I have a crazy idea. How about I go and find a whole bunch of films that have the word love in their titles, and from those particular prints, I pull the leaders off and then assemble them into a little montage. And about an hour later, I got an email back from Dan. It's the only one-word email I've ever received, and it simply said, love. So. Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to let you know, the dedication for Stephen Parr, we'll have another session a little bit later on Stephen Parr. Let me give you a quick rundown about the next 50 minutes or so. We're talking about archival education about orphan works. We'll start out with some formal presentations from the newest archival program, Ryerson University. And then we'll move to some kind of quick off-the-cuff summaries from two of the other programs. Then we'll open for a panel discussion, and we'll ask people in the audience to contribute information about how they're using orphan works in within their pedagogy. Most of the speakers so far have tried to tie their presentations to the conference theme of love, sometimes by very creative kind of reinterpretations of the word love or modifying the word. I think particularly for this panel, I think we need to make sure that everyone's on board that we are not using the legal definition of the word orphans, which really means we do not know who owns this. Instead, we're using the a modified definition of neglected works. So that's really important to note. So let me introduce the Ryerson folks. First will be Dmitry Lotsits, faculty member and director of their program, then David Emery and Isaac Prusky.
Thank you, Howard, and thanks to Dan and everybody here for a wonderful 3 days thus far. I'm just hated that I didn't think of the love and maple syrup that we just saw. That would have been a better title than mine, but in any case. So the idea about this kind of was prompted by broader discussion within EMEA and elsewhere of archival kind of pedagogy now being 20 years old, pretty much, since formal programs were instituted, to start and think about how is it we teach, what it is we teach, and where do we go from here as the field is kind of evolving. And what I want to kind of talk about, and you'll hear from two of our second-year students in a minute, is how do we teach about and with orphan materials, as I'm sure many of you do as well, in terms of the practical components of it, assignments, assessment, and so forth, and also the ethical, legal, and so forth components, as kind of Howard alluded to. So our program, Master in Film and Photography Preservation and Collections Management, FPPCM, which used to be PPCM, since its inception, it's more than 10 years ago, and its relationship with the George Eastman House, now museum, however, acquired the film stream since 2013. So it's the fifth year of the film stream with the first graduates in 2015, as you see here. And the curriculum very much evolved to kind of encompass both photographic and film pedagogy with archival and curatorial components. So the orphan seminar within that was introduced in 2014. This is a fourth year being taught. As far as I'm aware, it's the only regularly scheduled course on orphans in a broader sense in one of these programs. We teach in the second year of the program for film track students. And the context of it is that we do it instead of a second year of film history historiography, which the photography students do, because the assumption is that history of photography is not taught as extensively as history of film in the undergraduate level. So part of it also has to do with, and I want to kind of point out that the people that have taught it before me, that are very prominent experimental filmmakers, you see on the left, Herta Kamara's book with Zoë Druk, that some of you might be familiar with, and then Bruce Elder, of course, and they use in their practice very often found footage, So the point of view that the course has been taught up to now very much reflects that in terms of praxis, in terms of working hands-on, and I've tried to kind of carry on that legacy. But of course, you know, coming from where I do, the idea is to also extend it to the digital realm and also more historiography, the background of it, as we wonderfully do in the context of conferences like this one. So some of the tools and materials that we have to work with include collections of educational films from the National Film Board, from various deaccession collections of libraries of 16.8 and Super 8, and some more examples. This is our in-house archive versus the Ryerson Libraries have their own archive. And what we try and do is to kind of both inspect, project, and curate programs, but also we are increasingly kind of introducing this digital dimension with the scanner that we just acquired. We have a full service chemical and digital lab in-house, and we try and get our students acclimated to that from the get-go, and insist on kind of both the analog and the digital component of orphans. So I want to give an example of this. Here's just an inspection and handling station. The context of kind of where all this comes from, and the background comes from our periodic program review. I know many of you faculty members out there have to go through this drudge every 10 years or so. And we thank you also to the archivists like Chris Horak and Sue Oxtoby that have done the reviews for us. Very informative and very important for us moving forward. So some examples of where Orphan slips into the context of the program, it consists of archival visits to local archives, as you see here, guest lecturers and speakers, sometimes on issues like copyrights, which I know have a wide national degree of variation. So that's something also to think about. How do we address copyright within pedagogy? And also this idea that we have to teach a political history of orphan collections along with that. And this is very much reflected in the assignments and in the institutions where I'll say that our students have worked with orphan materials in a minute. So this is an example of an assignment from this past fall's course in terms of, I'm sure some of you might have done variations of it, an adoption of a film for the National Film Registry or a home movie for the Amateur Cinema Database, and the tracking of the materials, the really hands-on work that goes into identifying a film that exists and in what condition it exists. Another one is grant writing. So kind of trying to balance the historical context of it with the more kind of practical necessities that students will have to do when they go out there in putting together these grants and rough estimates and so forth. Actually, this panel also was part of an assignment for them as well. So, you know, when it's hear about grades afterwards. So these are some of the places where our graduates have dealt with orphan materials, including right now, as you hear from David, one of our students that is at the iFilm Institute, and along with two others has been accepted into the FIAF summer workshop in Bologna, where very often they deal with material like the ones we've been seeing this past 3 days. And Isaac, who also a second-year student who is at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, working with a wide swath of material that cuts across performing arts and visual arts, and examples of thesis that have to do with orphan material. Very often we see it, and you see the names of the supervisors as well, home movies, dance film and video, the Anthology Film Archive, Super 8mm film collection there. So I just want to kind of stop there because I want to give the time to our students, and then hopefully what I want to do is provoke a discussion afterwards. How do you guys approach teaching with that material? What are some of the roadblocks that you come up ahead? This is part of the larger context. I very much encourage you to check out the special issue of Synoptique out of Concordia that is on archival moving archives and pedagogy just recently. It's a whole special issue. And I know that I'll see many of you, in fact, in the panel that I'll be on next month in Amsterdam, where we'll talk about, you know, similar to pedagogies against the grain. So let's keep this conversation going, and I hope that EMEA will become a forum for that annually with Moving Image Archive Pedagogy. But I'll pass it on now to, is it David? Or, let's see, Isaac.
Awesome. Well, good morning, everyone, or I should say afternoon at this point. Thank you for being here today. As Dimitra said, my name is Isaac Preske, and my presentation will cover educational film, which is what I focus most of my research on in the Ryerson Orphan Film course we are discussing on this panel. With this presentation, I hope to give you a glimpse at orphan films that speak the most to me, as well as the areas of orphan film research my cohorts and I explored through the assignments we were given. I will also touch on how this relates to the work I'm currently completing as part of my residency here in New York. Just as a brief note, the photo you see here is of two of, to me, the most amazing and pioneering filmmakers to emerge out of Canada, husband and wife duo F.R. Budge and Judith Crawley of Crawley Films, on set with their five children. I've included this here because the Crawleys and their educational films are of great interest to me and often became a focal point for my research in this course. So the first assignment we were given was to analyze an orphan film and argue for its cultural, historical, and aesthetic significance. We were expected to investigate in detail its production and distribution information, technical or creative innovations that made it a notable or influential work, and most importantly, confirm its copyright status and print accessibility. For this assignment, I chose Roman Kreuter and Colin Lowe's classic educational film Universe, which I argued was representative of the often overlooked interrelation between commercial and non-commercial film over the past century, i.e. its influence on Kubrick, 2001 A Space Odyssey, as well as it being more an orphan of aesthetic and intellectual neglect, as opposed to a work abandoned necessarily by its copyright holder. The next assignment we were given was to research and present on a type of orphan film, for which, again, I chose educational film. My motivation for this was to explore, as I've said, the aforementioned F.R. Budge and Judith Crawley's prolific production company, Crawley Films, which was responsible for multiple educational film series distributed in Canada and the United States, most notably in the 1950s. Focusing upon their sexual education series and using films such as How Much Affection and Age of Turmoil as case studies, I argue that the Crawleys have been historically underrepresented in independent film history due to their corporate connections and exclusively non-commercial output. The Crawleys believed in high production values, hiring professional actors and actresses, shooting on location, and even employing experimental film techniques, which I feel makes them very fascinating and very unique orphan films and filmmakers to study. Now, the assignment that followed this, which Dimitros has just touched on, is we were required to create a mock NFPF grant for the preservation of an orphan film we could gain physical access to. So for this assignment, I sourced another great Crawley educational film, He Acts His Age, from the 16mm film collection housed within our film preservation lab at Ryerson University. We were required to inspect and evaluate the condition of the print and then make a case for its preservation based on a series of criteria. This criteria included previous areas of research that I've mentioned, such as providing a summary of the film's historic, thematic, and aesthetic significance, copyright status. However, recreating the structure of an actual NFPF grant introduced us to the practicalities of preservation we would need to consider in this scenario, which meant researching and quoting out preservation costs and timelines. Ultimately, I made the case for the photochemical preservation of the Ryerson print of He Acts His Age through Niagara Custom Labs and Photochem, as well as digitization through a Toronto-based company, Digital Treasures. For our final assignment, we were instructed to write program notes for a film we would hypothetically or realistically locate a print or digital file of, and then screen at this very event. For the purposes of this panel, I chose to elaborate more on the coursework I completed as a whole, but I will provide an overview of the film I put forth as a programming candidate for this symposium. So the film that I chose was The Horror of It All, a 1983 documentary intended for educational purposes on the history of horror films stretching back to the silent era. Directed by Gene Feldman and produced by Wombat Productions, the film was structured as a series of rare talking head interviews with people such as John Carradine, Roger Corman, Martine Beswick, as well as a compilation of notable horror film scenes and performances. It was intended to reconcile horror film trends perceived as extreme or illicit in the 1980s with those produced in the early to mid-20th century, and it features a wide scope of actors, actresses, filmmakers, critics offering their opinions for consideration. It was broadcast by PBS and BBC and then released on VHS by MPI Video, long since out of print and now a very desirable collector's item. With the idea of love or cinephilia in mind, which is what sort of the motivation of programming the film was, this film stuck out to me as both kind of a loving tribute to an often disregarded genre, as well as a wonderful encapsulation of what it is to experience horror films. And by that, I mean the film features many fascinating scenes of audience reactions to viewing horror films and points to sort of the levity or emotional release that comes with the experience of watching them. So lastly, I'm just going to touch upon the work that I'm currently completing as part of my residency at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, and how my work in the Orphan Films course has influenced me to continue researching and working on the preservation of educational film. So during my discussions with my supervisor and head archivist of the Reserve Film and Video Collection, Elena Rossi Snook, we realized that there was no all-encompassing best practices guide for programming educational film or film for educational purposes, specifically for young audiences in public libraries. So we have begun constructing this guide based on research into all existing publications on educational film, children's film, programming film in libraries, which we hope to release by the end of the summer. This will also include recommendations for educational films to program, sourced and previewed from the Reserve Film and Video Collection that we feel are best suited for different age groups. Furthermore, we will be running the very first Film Society Kids Workshop of the year this Wednesday, where we introduce young audiences to 60mm film and screen educational films for them to enjoy and discuss afterwards. The first film to be screened in this series will be Elliot Noyes' classic children's film Bad Dog, where we introduce young audiences to technique, style, and perspective through the film's dog eye point of view and seek to instill in them the sense of wonder educational film can still inspire. Although this does not appear on my final slide, I would just like to close by mentioning that Elena and I are also in the process of writing an actual NFPF grant for a Angela Davis film print that we have just recently obtained at the library. So the research I completed for my aforementioned mock grant in the Orphans Film course has been extremely helpful for guiding my work in this regard. And with that, thank you again for being here and giving your time, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the symposium.
Next up, David Emery from Ryerson.
Thanks very much for having me. This is great. It's also my first ever conference presentation, so I'll take any of the sympathy I have coming for me. Isaac's in the same boat, too. He did a great job. I'm going to touch on what Isaac mentioned in his presentation is that assignment for the Orphan Film Symposium proposal that we did as an assignment for Demetrios's class. And I'm also going to touch on the use of orphan films as an educational and promotional tool that allows us to overcome the limitations of our eye. My talk will reflect the theme of this conference, love, primarily in the form of cinephilia. And I'll focus on Ideas and Film, an American film produced circa 1959 by Bell and Howell and made available by Periscope Film. And I do have a clip, if we could show it.
Does it? What? Oh, no, it should be here. Is it this one?
It's an MP4.
It's an MP4. Okay. Do you want to get the desktop?
Which one is it?
You keep talking, and I'll bring it to you on a USB stick.
No, it's on the desktop, isn't it? No, it's not here. Okay.
Is this Is this it? Thanks to everyone for their assistance with that. So Bell & Howell Company formed in Chicago in 1907 as a manufacturer of motion picture projectors. The company relied on sponsored films to promote its products for years. How Motion Pictures Move and Talk, produced by Castle Films in 1939, showcased the sound recording process and the creation of release prints. A later project, Ideas and Film, was produced through Telecine Film Studios. In 1959, at the second annual Harrogate Festival of Films for Industry, Bell & Howell made good use of the film in exhibiting its equipment and laboratory services alongside Ariflex as part of a manufacturer's presentation. So Ideas and Film is introduced with the narrator's words over military footage. We are seeing a guided missile. This begs an additional consideration. Film allows us to see a guided missile. Throughout Ideas and Film, the ability of film to capture precarious situations is celebrated. The death of an exploding light bulb, the ejection of a fighter pilot, an atomic bomb exploding. Portrayed as superior to the human eye, film can slow and hasten time, make the invisible visible, and eliminate the barriers of distance and national reach. For companies, motion studies in the vein of those conducted by Frank and Lillian Gilbreth unify worker efficiency and competence. Safety and human relations footage helps to improve productivity and worker morale, and demonstrations allow customers to see products in action, from washing machines to farming equipment. What Ideas and Film promotes foremost is the capacity of the user of film technologies to apply those technologies in new and important ways. Although the film camera allows us to view a plethora of subjects, it's only as useful as the individual who decides where to point it. In doing so, we must address challenges to our eye, distance, danger, the universe, large and small. When photomicrography opens our perception to the microscopic world, or projections are made about the role of film in humanity's conquest of space, the viewer's position is transformed from passive participant into potential creator. So Ideas in Film is poignant in its identification of film's relationship with the subject. Without the development of the missile, this motion picture would not exist. But without motion pictures to aid in their development, missiles might not exist. This observation speaks to an audience's reliance on visual information and the trust placed in its presentation. We love the camera because it never lies, because it lets us make up our own minds and invent our own ideas. In Metzian terms, film technology satisfies the scopophilic drive, or desire to see, because it allows us to see ad infinitum. No piece of equipment is too tall, no bridge too slow to close to escape our viewpoint. And using Bell & Howell technology, we can exceed our own abilities with the evidence there on the screen. And this can be communicated to an enormous audience, directly identified as the populations absorbing film content through television, theaters, schools, churches, factories, and meetings. Ideas in Film expresses its cinephilia in its extolling of film's character and possibilities. It gleefully observes that while time waits for no man, it waits for film, offering us unlimited access to anything placed in front of a camera, a temptation that's driven generations of filmmakers to point and shoot. Finally, the film expresses a love for country, and especially for America's policies and potential for future progress heading into the 1960s. Professional and amateur archives alike love the underappreciated role film played in the development of sociocultural norms and its overlooked status as public educator. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, so now we're moving away from these formal presentations to much more informal and general presentations. So next up is Graham Marshall from UCLA, who will just discuss how UCLA is using orphan works in their curriculum.
Hi, everyone. Thank you again for having me. Thank you, Howard and Dan, and also to Snowden Becker and Dino Everett for their mentorship throughout the program. But just a brief overview of UCLA. Since we got rid of our moving image archival track, or our studies degree, we ended up deciding to go for an MLIS, which is a Master of Library and Information Science. So it's a lot more general of a degree, but the way we incorporate orphan films, off the cuff indeed, is we really try and balance the mix of practical study and theoretical study, and that can always be a tough challenge with any academic discipline, but kind of highlighting from the previous speakers, using visits, guests, and really in-class examples has been the most demonstrable way we've been able to deal with orphan films and neglected films. And we also highlight in our program the social justice aspect of preservation and archival science. And I guess the question we look at is, of course, we look at how to preserve, why, and what matters when we do preserve it, but also why media is neglected in the first place. I think the politics of that are as important as anything else, and we focus on trying to investigate why some things are intentionally neglected, maybe unintentionally. It's a delicate mix of practical and theoretical studies. So I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
So last up is Dylan Lorenz from NYU's MIAP program. And I should say that Dylan is only doing this at the last minute. Becca Bender, who was supposed to be doing this, lost her voice. And so he's filling in. Likewise, one of the Ryerson, this was not an all white male panel. One of the a female from Ryerson was originally slated but couldn't make it too. So, Dylan.
I don't have anything formally prepared, but just to talk about generally how orphan works are used in the MIAP curriculum. One thing with the core classes early, there's the with the intro to MIAP, use some kind of, often it's footage from the South Carolina USC Merck collection. And there's been actually very interesting things that have come out of that, some of the MIAP work that led into orphans presentations. The one we worked on was actually a 16 millimeter home movie that they didn't understand even why it was with the nitrate in the vaults, but that was something that I worked on with a few people and couldn't identify the family, but got an idea of where they were visiting in the world. With the copyright class, it is getting into this idea of what Howard brought up, which is this difference between this kind of formal idea of what is an orphan footage in this case, because these are, we often work with the WNET to kind of identify footage from these when from these public television stations before they were part of PBS. A lot of footage there is just kind of there may not be documentation. They're just trying to figure out who owns what in order to even be able to, you know, get the material out in public. And just, you know, just to say that you have seen some of the work of working with Orphan Materials. Yesterday there was the laser image. Melanie Moser worked at Bill Brand's film preservation class. She kind of jumped on that, working on the grant for that project that you saw the results of yesterday. And also just beginning the conference, just from internships, there was Becca's, you know, presentation that finding that footage of Einstein, and also Frenny Tremps working with the Girl Scouts, working with that footage there, you know, kind of led off the Orphans this year. And I guess the last, well, there are also a couple of thesis films involving kind of working with Mexican home movies, and also a home movie collection of a family is also a part of kind of the capstone of a few people graduating this year. Wanted to just quickly mention just APEX is something, the Audiovisual Preservation Exchange. I can't speak to the previous years, but a lot of that footage, definitely in terms of the classification of orphans for the symposium, most of the work there is being that would qualify for that. Last year, I was a part of the APEX in Cartagena, Spain, and it was working with someone who's been mentioned a couple times in presentations, Clara de Jesus Sanchez, who works with amateur films from mostly northern Spain, and we also work with some home movies in southern Spain in the Murcia region that are just being, it's this sort of, it started with some artists wanting to work with incorporating footage in their work, and led to this large sort of archivist by default, working with this, capturing a lot of material from this particular region in Spain. So that's about it. Just to kind of cover things with me up.
Okay. Can all the speakers come up here? Can we bring the house lights up? And are any of these not tethered?
Why don't you come over here?
So first off, can we have some comments from people in the audience about people in the audience might be using this material, this type of material? Is that Stephanie?
I'm Stephanie. I'm a non-white male at University of Maryland on the research faculty, and I work in their Digital Humanities Center, MYTH. And Oliver Gaken and I actually have a couple projects, and I've also worked on a couple projects which utilize orphan works in our pedagogy. Oliver and I were working on a four-part graduate colloquium with the African American Culture, History, and Digital Humanities Mellon-funded project. As part of that, it's basically looking at the intersections between digital humanities, libraries and archives, and Black and African American studies, and trying to think through projects that can incorporate those better. And we digitized four films from the AFL-CIO labor collection at Maryland that were in the circulating collection on 16, and the class basically got into groups, or the colloquium participants got into groups and investigated them through an annotated portal, or we looked at different resources and talked about the history of race and labor and how those films were produced, what audiences they were produced for, and what purpose they served. And we're actually in the process of taking that project further, looking at the rest of the AFL-CIO collection and trying to get professors to start to incorporate these materials into their coursework. And I also taught a workshop as part of the AdHume initiative on there are different modules of workshops that are about different aspects of Black studies, and this one was about movement and the arts and audiovisual storytelling. So I taught a module where I incorporated some of the Black Rebellion films by Haile Gerima and Barbara McCullough as examples of individual life of the Black experience and individual life as represented in art, and talked about sort of how they utilize audiovisual storytelling methods differently than, for example, narrative storytelling or documentary. And then I'm also working with Dan on trying to get, if anybody wants to work on this, this is my plug, on trying to get aggregated, this is actually well in development, all of the previous orphan film symposium presentations and films into a centralized portal and website that can be searched. And I'm hoping that this would actually encourage more educators to use the portal to research and utilize orphan works in their classrooms. So that's Maryland.
Thanks. So now we're getting outside the area of archival education. Charlie, you want to say something?
Well, one thing I'd say is that Brian Meacham, you should talk to, is teaching an archival course within our graduate program. So we do have like a course that's specifically devoted. I mean, I think he uses orphan films as a kind of mechanism. But, I'm feeling my age a little bit, because I do feel like the orphan film movement in some way, with Dan as like the breakthrough figure here, and other people came out of a fascination with early cinema, and these films really were orphaned and discarded. They weren't, film art didn't begin with Griffith, so anything before Griffith was really uninteresting. So I teach a course on basically the formation of the classical Hollywood cinema, and a really substantial portion of those films are or were orphaned. I mean, of course, given the definition that you just offered us, there's a way in which films sometimes migrate from being orphaned to being non-orphaned, right? I mean, I think that we could say that about Oscar Michaud. Those films, his silent films definitely were orphaned films at one point, but now they're highly treasured.
Allie?
Gosh, well, I feel like I the one thing that's different maybe than what folks have been saying is I really like in teaching to emphasize the vast majority of early films that are lost. So I spend a lot of time on thought. Dan would, if I said non-extant film, he would say presumed non-extant film. So we spend a lot of time thinking about lostness and absence. So I have students, go into the trades, which are thankfully digitized thanks to some folks here, into newspapers and things like that, and research titles, and try to find as much information about exhibition history, production histories, and things about the lost items as a way to inform and round out what we do know about what does survive and what we have access to. So there's that.
Great.
I want to make something which I hope doesn't sound like a quibble or a picking of nits, but I, Demetrios, in your introductory remarks to this session, you spoke about this being stimulated by the fact that archival education is coming up on 20 years old. It's actually closer to 30 years old, and the East Anglia program, which was first discussed in 1989 and established in 1990, I'm not super good at math, but I think we're coming up on 30 for that. But that did grow out of the East Anglia Film Archive, which was a regional archive and dealt with regional historical films, non-theatrical media, and the regional film archives movement, which challenged those ideas of feature cinema and national cinemas and refocused on the local and the historical and sort of the culturally significant in other ways. So I just want to make a plea for us that we be not ahistorical about this, but perhaps provoke the thought that we should be thinking about not the ways that we have traditionally taught about orphan films, but think about ways in which it is now possible for us to teach orphan films differently than previously.
Thanks for pointing it out, Snowden, and I'm absolutely for this expanded definition of pedagogy. I mean, if you think of the Northeast Historic Film, they do an annual workshop on material that's orphan every summer. And so there's plenty of precedent even before the East Anglia. I mean, since we are partly hosted by NYU, I'll just remind people of Jay Leidis, film begets film, and the precedent of the use and teaching in the classroom with films, early film as well. So yeah, I didn't mean to imply. When you do a historiography, you kind of start with what's formally recorded, and then you emphasize the unrecorded histories and the underrepresented histories, and local and regional is definitely part of that.
Hi. I just wanted to speak because I am in the UCLA program. I'm a year under Graham, and I just wanted, I think one thing Graham was touching on is that our program, like, I know people don't know what's going on with it all the time since our title has changed, but one thing that has not changed that Graham did mention is social justice, and I think that that came into play with Sean's presentation yesterday. I think that idea of social justice and identity helps us think about the ethical problems that inevitably come up and our responsibility as archivists. And I think that that is actually a strength of our program that is woven through all of the courses, especially with a foundational library degree, which deals with the access of that material and the responsibility that that comes with. I loved Mila's presentation yesterday, which I thought also was a perfect example of things that an archivist, Anne Gilland, has written a lot about, like about archives in countries where maybe that country doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, who does that belong to? What does that mean? What does ownership become? Or how people deal with that. I do think another thing that I just wanna mention, and maybe this is like a defensive thing of trying to talk about our program, but I do think that Dino Everett is amazing and bringing orphans in terms of orphan technology. His courses are about obsolete technology, it's very hands-on. Snowden is amazing in providing all of the literature and history of orphan material, whereas we have a new professor, Jean Vincourt, who just started an entire course on collectors and the material that collectors have brought and their like evolving role within the archival field. And I will apologize because I came in a little late, but I was wondering, what was the impetus for creating your course on orphans? How did you identify that need that you felt it needed to be filled?
Yeah, I think it came out of the initial assessment that I mentioned Chris Horek did when we introduced the film stream. And it was, on the one hand, to not have a second film historiography course. As I mentioned, you know, for history photography there is, because it's less formally taught at the undergraduate level. And to represent the wide variety of materials that realistically our graduates would intern and do the residencies in and then work on. So we looked at past placements, we look at institutions collaborating with us, and we saw that a lot of the material is material that's problematic from the point of view of ownership, of neglect of the physical material, born digital material that's neglected. So there was that need to teach that in a more formal manner. Now, the way that we went about, as I said, initially had to do more with artists, found footage experimental filmmakers, teaching along that model, which did include background and history, but it morphed into a more kind of structured, practical, and theoretical course on the history of orphans and the prospects going forward. So that's the history of that course. And I did want to mention, because people have been pointing out representation issues and archives at risk. Archives at risk is a major focus of ours going forward. My colleagues Janine Marchessault and Marta Brown wanted me to mention this. York University, Concordia, and Ryerson have just received a major grant from the Social Science and Humanities Research Council to do a multi-year project on archives, moving image archives at risk. And especially with focus on indigenous archives and LGBTQ two-spirit archives. So if you have an interest in that, please come forward, please be in touch with us, because there are gonna be a series of symposia, a series of books, and online platforms related to that theme.
Hi, I'm Gemma, and I'm a Selznick grad. And so as I moved into media archiving and researching, I have mostly found it to be unsustainable economically, and both inside the archive, doing the archival work, and as an archivist, particularly as somebody who, as I adore as a caretaker, the audiovisual materials also moved into being a caretaker of tiny human beings. So my experience and my research actually coming out of this was based on Rick Prelinger and the work that Rick was suggesting and Mark Newman and Karen Sheldon about integration really led me out of library sciences, although my heart remains in media studies and library sciences, into education and more broadly PK through 12 in the instructional design perspective. So and again, in thinking regionally, we don't have the workforce to support, in where I come from in Maine, a more sustainable model of media archiving. And thinking forward, how we can't necessarily afford to bring in people from out of state to develop the kind of technological shift that we need. And nor for media archiving, and we don't necessarily, so we don't have a library sciences program in our state. We have to go out of state, or, and we don't even actually have the despite over a decade and a half of learning technology, we're still in a lot of ways in pre-K through 12 education coming up to date with virtual communications. So backing up to how am I working with, how am I supporting Orphan Works and non-theatrical film, I'm thinking about it more forward thinking as a workforce, as and building, thinking about how do we do this sustainably, and that goes deeper into work that Northeast Historic Film started decades ago, in integrating this content into lower levels of education. So you're talking about on higher education level, and that's very important. And we've got some wonderful programs now. And I'm interested in how do we bring it out of cinema studies? How do we bring it into more classrooms, reach younger people, and a wider audience?
Okay.
Sorry, so you're interested in younger audiences having that experience? Yeah. Right, of course. I don't know, so in the latter part of my presentation, I talked a bit about the workshops that we do at the New York Public Library, which is a big motivation, a big motivational factor behind that, I think, is that introduction of film as material. I mean, the circumstance of it being orphan film is a lovely coincidence in that sense as well, but it's all about teaching the ages you've indicated about what film is, what it can be used for, its creative potential, its historical significance, and it's an incredibly gratifying work. It really is, and it's some of the best experiences I've had thus far as part of my residency, so I agree. I'd love to see more of that as well.
Okay, so Brianna made the comment about how UCLA weaves in social justice into the various things they do. Sure. Could the other programs comment on how they do that or what they do? Yeah.
Sure. I mean, we both in terms of, it's important to emphasize that this is kind of a whole cycle, right? It starts with recruitment, assessing applications of prospective, graduate students. And a major, focus in the Canadian context is, as the policy of the state is, diversity. It's in the official policy of Canada to emphasize diversity in all the forms of race, ability, national origin, increasingly. So that is a kind of a first step. Then we look at the places where people intern, and we try and identify places that are not, aside of the usual FIEF archives, that are libraries, small regional, local, historical societies, and people working there very often run into home movies, have to kind of make up an archive as they go along, and there are no resources, which is something that we haven't talked about a lot, kind of archivists working in places that are not traditionally archival, right? So that's part of the diversity to my mind. And then in terms of you know, just the diversity of the faculty that we have, both professional, adjunct, and the permanent faculty, it's important for us to kind of achieve parity in terms of gender, which I think in our program we're close to, and to kind of cultivate a culture of belonging. And I'm kind of very glad to see EMEA moving toward that direction, enshrining diversity, doing a whole theme of a conference on diversity, which I wouldn't say it's the case for SCMS. And I did point that out in the recent conference in Toronto. And but you guys want to also speak about Dylan?
Well, I think it's a lot to do with, say similar things, but yes, a lot to do with the collections that that are sought out for internships, and there's, it being New York, there are a lot of available places, both from diversity from like the La Mama Theater and it's going to be difficult for me to kind of give the full kind of spectrum of things, but I could say that I'll say that I don't represent the MEAP classes. I don't think there's a pretty diverse set of students, both in terms of gender, in terms of gender orientation and interests. There's been thesis on working with transgender terminology in metadata, and there's the program definitely, I think, seeks to kind of create a diverse student body, but also to encourage people to go towards their interests. So I think I could say that.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We've been running way late today. So if you'd thank the panelists.
Thank you, Howard. Maybe this is my chance to, if it's not been apparent, so there's a group of students in MEAP's curating class who've been working in front of and behind the scenes, working on it all semester long as part of curricular experience. So I thank them for all their labors as well. Dylan was one of those people. Dylan also made the trailers for Orphans 10. So we do lots of stuff. Let's gather back here in an hour. Lunch down the hall. Thanks.